We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Day. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Let's get to this week's underreported, misreported news, starting with I-522. Developments there.
Yeah, this week several labor groups said that they were supporting the Initiative 522, which is the GMO labeling initiative to label foods that contain genetically modified organisms, including firefighters, nurses, and farm worker unions. They specified that GMO crops require more chemicals to grow them. In fact, that's why they're genetically engineered, is to withstand the heavy use of pesticides. And farm workers in particular said that they're supporting I-522 because, of course, working with those ever-increasing levels of chemicals in the fields is having a serious impact on the health of farm workers.
Yeah. I having spent a summer when I was young doing migrant farm work, that stuff is nasty, 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 nasty.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you know, if it's impacting the health of farm workers, you got to be asking yourself, what's it doing to me, and especially what's it doing to my children? So, yeah, it's a good reason to be supporting I-522. Now, bad news for I-522, a Thurston County judge this week dismissed the lawsuit by the pro-522 folks regarding the Grocery Manufacturers Association not disclosing their donors. They said that was a violation of public disclosure laws. The Thurston County judge disagreed with them. He didn't rule on the merits of the case, though. He decided that it wasn't something that could be that the suit could not be brought within 5 weeks after it had to do with the timing of when the suit was brought versus when the public disclosure filings were made. And the judge decided that no, the requisite 5 weeks had not passed yet.
That's kind of useless when you're a month before the election.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And that's what the Pro 522 people said. The judge also, in addition to dismissing the case, he ruled that the Pro 522 folks had to pay $10,000 plus attorney fees to the anti 522 folks. And you know that the anti 522 people are going to be using these high paid corporate attorneys. So that's a significant financial penalty for the folks who are promoting the I-522.
What about the countersuit that the anti folks had launched?
Hasn't been ruled
on
yet.
Okay.
All right. Also, Initiative 594.
Another initiative, I-594, turned in 250,000 signatures this week. For folks not familiar with it, I-594 would require background checks for private gun purchases.
A statewide initiative.
Yes, it would close the gun show loophole. It requires background checks for online gun purchases and all private sales, and that includes gun shows and sales between individuals. The initiative needs about 246,372 signatures. So that 250,000 that were turned in, that's just a first batch.
Yeah, they need more to actually make sure that they have enough to cover all the ones that aren't actually valid.
Yeah, and once it clears that hurdle, I'm assuming it will. Once it clears that hurdle, the initiative will then go to the state legislature in this next legislative session in January, who can do one of a couple of things. They can pass it into law, in which case they would have a chance to add amendments to it if they wish, or they can send it to a public vote by the voters to decide whether or not to make it a law. Earlier this year, I just want to point out, in this last legislative session, a similar bill died in the state Senate.
Yeah, and that's often why we have these statewide initiatives. It's because the legislature doesn't do its job.
Yeah.
And in the case of the gun show loophole, of course, the Republicans staged a coup this past year, and even with the minority, were controlling the state Senate, and that's why it died there, because all of the Republicans who were controlling the state Senate opposed closing the gun show loophole.
Yeah, even though it passed with a healthy majority in the House.
All right. Also this week, the first mayoral debate for Seattle.
Yeah, I don't know how many folks listening to the show this morning actually saw the mayoral debate on Wednesday on King 5 TV, but I tuned in and I watched it. And the first thing
You need a social life.
The first thing I thought of on Wednesday night when I was watching the mayoral debate was the format in itself was deeply unsatisfying for someone like me who likes to hear candidates' real stances on the issues and likes to hear people talk about these things in depth. The format really rewarded style over substance. It was
and
the
brevity.
The candidates were given 1 minute to answer each question, and they were allowed a 30-second follow-up or what would be termed a rebuttal. Really, this format rewarded a person like McGinn, who comes across very well. He's a very good public speaker, very good salesman, particularly in selling himself, and didn't reward someone like Murray, who's known for sitting down with folks and talking through things and kind of thinking out loud.
Yeah. And is much more of a policy wonk.
Yeah, he didn't come across nearly as well. The current mayor, McGinn, might seem to have actually won it, you know, because he's so slick and he addressed the camera. He did all the things that Murray didn't do. But on substance, I think Murray really stood out. And I want to point out, too, that McGinn did what he is notorious for. He took a lot of credit for things that other people have done. In particular, what really needled me was that he took credit for bringing all the parties to the table on police reform. And I just want to point out that is deeply untrue. As anyone who's been listening to our show for a while knows, McGinn resisted help. He resisted input from community groups. He resisted input from the city council, even pushed them out of the negotiations with the Department of Justice.
Used his own private attorney.
Yes. He resisted getting any advice from the city attorney. He used his own private attorney because he didn't trust the advice from the city attorney. He resisted the Department of Justice at every step of the process. It was the judge. Who brought in a monitor, and the monitor who brought all these different groups to the table. And that's what McGinn is taking credit for.
Yeah, he brought everybody to the table in the sense that his intransigence and lack of willingness, not even to negotiate, but even to acknowledge that there was a problem with SPD, forced everybody to, forced the feds to threaten to sue. And, I mean, you can say that McGinn brought people to the table in the same way that you can say, a mass murderer brought everybody to that courtroom. I mean, it was not an honest presentation at all.
No. And, you know, and McGinn kept trying to pin Murray down and say, you know, that he as one member of a legislative body had to be responsible for everything that the legislature had done or not done in the last 18 years. And Murray was not going to take that. He basically said, well, I'm going to take credit for the things I worked on. You know, and I'm not going to take credit for the stuff that I didn't actually work on, you know, and that I didn't actually vote the wrong way on, you know, but McGinn didn't understand that. And he clearly was trying to push him to take credit for things that he shouldn't take credit for. But that's McGinn's style, you know, and that's the main reason I think why he has to be voted out.
Yeah, he's an attorney, and that training shows through in his public speaking, and especially in his debate presentation. It's very adversarial, and of course that governing style is also a reflection of that approach.
All yeah. Right. And so I want to remind people, too, there's two more televised debates. There's one on Como TV this coming Tuesday, October 15th, and Como is Channel 4. And there's a third and final one on KCTS 9 on Wednesday, the 22nd. So
the election is November 5th. Ballots will arrive next Friday or Saturday. Actually, maybe a few people will get it Thursday. And so we'll start going through the ballot on the show next week. So look forward to that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on, local impacts from the federal shutdown.
Yeah. King County gave advanced layoff notices this week for a number of federal programs that employees that work with a number of programs that receive federal funding that are going to need to shut down as a trickle-down result of the federal shutdown should the shutdown continue. Most notable were 82 employees that are going to be laid off for the Women, Infant, and Children's Program. That program services 38,000 pregnant women, new mothers, and young children in King County and providing them with a healthier diet, hopefully one without genetically modified foods. and pesticides in their foods. But the upshot of this is that the federal shutdown, as with many other essential programs, veterans programs, preventative health programs, et cetera, is really impacting the people who need it most in terms of social services. The loss of funding, according to King County, will have a total economic impact of up to $30 million a year, just for that particular program, the WIC program, the Women, Infants, and Children, and $23 million of that goes directly for food to families. King County Executive Del Constantine had the pithiest quote on it, that they, meaning House Republicans, are literally taking food from the mouths of babies. They're also actually killing people, but that's you know, you can go down the laundry list of programs that are being shut down. And as with many local and state programs where we've seen budget cuts in recent years, the problem lies with the money that they're relying upon from the federal government to help get these programs going. You're seeing it for processing of mortgages. You're seeing it for vouchers for affordable housing for people. All these different programs where things are being held up because of
the things that don't get a lot of press, like the shutdown of the FDA and food inspections, for example.
And we're seeing this at the national level too. We'll transition into talking about the federal shutdown and the debt ceiling crisis. That the media coverage of this has all been horse race coverage about the negotiations. As with the sequester that we've been seeing all year, people are not talking about the actual human impact on people who are being affected by this shutdown.
Or they're showing cute pictures of children crying because the local park is shut down. I mean, that's not the real story here, but the real story is not getting reported.
So talk about more about the shutdown, the debt ceiling problem.
Yeah, and I want to talk a little bit about this attitude among Republicans that defaulting on U.S. government debt is going to be no big deal. There were plenty of comments this week by clueless Republicans.
I actually saw one. I think it was Ted Yellow of Florida who was saying, well, the markets will reward this because international investors will see that the U.S. is finally getting a hold of its debt problem.
Yeah, no.
That's delusional.
My favorite. I'm just gonna list three types of comments that I heard this week, and I want to explain why they're seriously wrong. One of them was, "We can still pay the interest. You know, that we don't have to pay the principal when it's due. We can just pay the interest." Another comment that I heard this week was, "Businesses pay their bills late, so can the government." You know, and then the third comment I want to mention that I find deeply disturbing is Treasury can choose not to default. They can take the money from other government programs to pay down the debt. Now, those three comments are probably the most common ones that you hear from these clueless Republicans.
I thought you were going to say the most idiotic comments.
No, not necessarily idiotic, but some of the most common ones. You know, are these three comments.
Those aren't exclusive.
No. And so I just want to point out what's wrong with them. Well, first off, you know, Paul Krugman and others have pointed out that short-term Treasury bills, I mean, clearly these are people who don't understand how the debt works, and they don't understand how the economy works. And Wall Street has been trying desperately this week to explain it to them. Paul Krugman and others have pointed out in the press that short-term Treasury bills are really a linchpin, a foundation piece in the global economy. Businesses, governments, investors worldwide, investment funds, et cetera, they all use short-term Treasuries to manage their cash flow. So they rely on the U.S. government to pay the principal on those bonds on time because they have it in mind that they're going to use these folks who buy government bonds have it in mind that they're going to use that cash when it gets paid back to them. And they know what they're going to use it for. And if it's not paid back on time, that undermines a huge sector of the economy.
And it's actually worse than that in terms of the U.S. economy, because the reason that they use U.S. Treasury bonds, even though these are people from all over the world, is because the stability and the predictability of the U.S. paying its bills. If the U.S. can no longer be relied upon to pay its bills on time, which is certainly what we're seeing here, and we're seeing that there's a major political party in the U.S. that doesn't doesn't think it's a priority, they're going to shift to other parts of the world and other mm-hmm. other instruments.
Yeah.
And that is that itself is going to have a huge long-term impact on the U.S. economy.
Yeah, and this is why China and Japan, who are our biggest creditors, they own the most U.S. treasuries of any country or any other single investor in the world. They both have been contacting the U.S. government and saying, look, you can't default. You cannot default. You know, that's gonna plunge our economies into chaos, and then the whole world is screwed. Okay, now, those three comments, the we can still pay the interest and not pay the principal. First off, only paying the interest and not paying the principal, that is called a default. Okay, so folks who say, oh, that's not really defaulting, they don't understand the definition of the word. Secondly, paying the principal late is a default. So folks who say, well, my business pays bills late, you know, why can't the U.S. government? They don't understand that their business maybe supports a few local businesses and a few local employees, whereas the U.S. government supports the world economy. And the U.S. government paying its bills late is a serious problem.
Yeah, that's the same kind of ignorance as, well, if your family has to balance its checkbook, so should the federal government. It's just not the same thing.
Yeah, and then the Treasury, and then saying that the Treasury can sit down and choose to draw money from other government programs to pay down the debt is showing a profound ignorance of the U.S. Government budget, because the only programs in the U.S. government's budget that have enough cash to pay down the U.S. government debt there's only really three of them. There's the budget for the Defense Department, there's the budget for Social Security, and there's the budget for Medicaid and Medicare.
Now, guess which ones the Republicans want to
pull. Yeah, the Republicans don't want to pull money from the defense budget, so they're basically saying grandma can starve and we're going to let poor people die on the street outside the front doors of hospitals all over the country so that the U.S. government can pay off its debt to foreign countries like China and Japan, to big investors and investment funds, to Wall Street, essentially, big banks. And that's just not a trade-off that I think is moral or that the U.S. public would like to make.
Yeah. Meantime, for all those people who've been complaining for low these many years that Democrats don't have a spine, they're actually showing one in this shutdown, and it's a good thing. There are so many things that you're not hearing from establishment media on this shutdown, but one of the main ones is what's motivating the Democrats to hold fast and firm on this. It's not even about the collapse of the global economy. It's a bigger issue than that. Although
Believe
the collapse of the global economy is, you know, not a small issue either. But you know, what they are seeing very correctly, and what you're not hearing from the media, because they are terrified of being accused of being biased if they frame this as for what it actually is, which is hostage taking.
It's
like, we're going to shoot grandma if you don't give us everything that we want, even though we lost at the ballot box and we lost in all these other wings, and we're not clearly,
yeah. And you know Americans understand that's morally wrong.
I'm getting to that.
Yeah.
But we've got a minority of a minority party in one of two houses of one third of the government, holding hostages and saying, give in to all our fantasy demands or we'll crash the global economy. And the Democrats are seeing very accurately that if they compromise on this, if they give the Republicans anything, if they give them a commemorative plaque for coming to the table, if they reward the Republicans in any way, this behavior will continue.
Yeah.
And we've seen this over and over again. This is, what, about the fifth time that the Republicans have tried to do something like this with the debt ceiling? We've seen it with budget negotiations. At every step of the way, intransigence for the Republicans and insisting that they get their way on issues, the Affordable Care Act being only one example, that they have already lost on legislatively and at the ballot box.
Yeah.
And what the Republicans are trying to do is basically a bloodless coup d'etat. It's, well, yes, Romney lost the election in 2012. Implement his entire platform, or we'll crash the global economy. That basically was the House bill that was passed, and that's why the Democrats are resisting it. Now, interestingly enough, even though you have the failure of the national media to report this in any kind of accurate context, the American public gets it. The polling that's being done on this, and it's one of the reasons why you're seeing cracks in the Republican unity on this. The Republican Party, as a result of this, and it's a shift that's happened very, very quickly, just over the past week and a half since the government shutdown has come to fruition, is basically as popular right now as the Ebola virus. Well, maybe less so. Malaria's carrying mosquitoes, maybe.
Yeah.
So you're seeing, even though the Republicans really had thought they had a lock on the House of Representatives until 2020 because of the gerrymandering with the last census, even in those districts that were supposedly drawn to be safe seats for Republicans, you're now seeing a majority of people polled showing that they prefer Democrats. If the election were held right now, and obviously we're still a year off and people's memories are short, but if the 2014 elections were held right now, Democrats would get a large majority in the House of Representatives just because of the public perception of who's responsible for this, even though you're getting equivocation and he said, she said kind of reporting out of the media. So it's very interesting that the public is picking up on this anyway.
Yeah. And I just want to point out, too, that folks might be tempted to look at our debt fight as similar to the European debt crisis. Well, it's not even close. In the European debt crisis, you had countries that had very serious problems with high levels of debt. That's not the case with the United States government. Our debt is not that high as a percentage of our GDP or gross domestic product. So I think that the media is also not asking the media has not been asking the real question of why do we even have a debt limit at all? Why have this arbitrary number that has to be revisited every year or every 6 months depending on what the budget is? It's not in the Constitution. You know, other countries have debt limits, but they're done in a much more reasonable way. Like I said, they're indexed to their gross domestic product, their GDP, so that when the economy expands, the government's then able to borrow more money. Well, that's not how we do it here. We just sit down and we assign an arbitrary number and say, this is our debt limit, and it can be removed at any time. It could be the Congress could vote to do away with the debt limit, or it could vote to do it in a different way. But you don't get that kind of reporting in the media.
All right. Just about 4 minutes left. Supreme Court this week.
Yeah. Supreme Court of the United States hearing McCutcheon v. FEC, Federal Elections Commission. This is once again an opportunity for the Supreme Court to strike down part of the campaign finance laws in this country. In this case, the barrier of cumulative campaign donation limits, which is to say that if you're giving maximum donations to a number of campaigns, you can only give so many of those in a two-year period. That's being challenged by a guy named Sean McCutcheon, along with the Republican National Committee, which is a co-plaintiff in the case. McCutcheon, head of a coal mining company. There's a sympathetic figure for you in Alabama. And you have to ask the question of why he's so concerned about making maximum donations in a state where his party already has all of the statewide offices and it's not usually contested very heavily. So why is he throwing his money around? But that be as it may, the Supreme Court heard the arguments this week. It looks likely to overturn that limit. This is a case that only applies to the 1,219 richest donors in the country in 2012. That's how many people came close to or exceeded the limit that's in place. That's still the free speech that the Supreme Court seems most concerned about protecting rather than the free speech of everybody else that is drowned out when people throw around that much money.
All right, moving on. A skills study out.
Yeah, the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is a group of 22 of the most economically developed countries in the world, did a study. They tested 160,000 people in the OECD countries plus Russia and Cyprus on their skills in literacy, math, and problem solving in technologically rich environments. So trying to get a handle on the average Americans and the average French and the average Japanese person's skills in reading, writing, arithmetic, and problem
and
solving.
And searching Google.
Yeah. And guess who ranked first? Japan ranked first in all three categories. And the country that ranked second? Finland. And then all the other top spots were taken by mostly Scandinavian countries. Where did the U.S. rank? Well, the U.S. ranked about in the middle in literacy. That's the good news. The bad news is that we ranked near the bottom in math and in problem-solving skills. U.S. results were also very highly polarized. We had more people in both the highest and lowest levels and very, very few people who actually fell in the center.
I'm going to guess there's a correlation with party there, too.
There's a correlation with class there. The kids that grow up in wealthier homes and in wealthier school districts tended to do much, much better here among U.S. testees. College in America, no surprise, is becoming too expensive for lower class folks and middle class folks to go to a decent school. K through 12 schools, too, have a huge funding gap between those school districts that can afford all the bells and whistles and tutors, private tutors, and the best teachers, and those school districts where teachers are not paid well, where class sizes are too large, where the curriculum suffers because there's not enough funding to provide the kids with the bells and whistles that they need to learn how to do the more complex kind of problem solving and the more complex kinds of skills that are required
in the modern economy. We even see that within school districts, like in Seattle, where the North End and South End schools are very different.
Yes, there's even disparities within school districts.
Events.
Several of them coming up today, of course, is the 521st anniversary of the beginning of the biggest and longest running genocide in human history. We have a federal holiday to celebrate it on Monday, but a better commemoration is today from 12 to 5 o'clock in Westlake Park, where there'll be a celebration of International Indigenous Peoples Day with rally and drums and speakers and so forth. So go check that out. Hopefully the rain will hold off for a while. Tomorrow, by the way, all this weekend, as we heard at 7:30, and hopefully people got some tickets to it at 8 o'clock, the Social Justice Film Festival will be going on. Check out the list of films at socialjusticefilmfestival.org. Tomorrow, Sunday the 13th, in the evening, Richard Dawkins will be in town, the philosopher and famous religious skeptic. It's sold out at Town Hall, but there will be a limited number of tickets available at the door, $5, Town Hall, 8th and Seneca. Monday, the 14th, from 6 to 9 o'clock, the Washington State Senate, that same organization that couldn't get a transportation bill passed last year, is holding a public hearing on what needs to be included in a transportation package. Hint, something, anything. Like they may be allowing us to fund our own bus system.
Service.
Yeah. And by the way, I left a word out of there in deference to the Federal Communications Commission.
Uh-huh.
That hearing from 6 to 9 o'clock Monday at First Presbyterian Church downtown at 8th and Spring in Seattle. Wednesday, the 18th from 6 to 8 o'clock, Syria, close up of a crisis, expert panel being presented by the World Affairs Council and Mercy Corps, which does a lot of great work in that part of the world. It's $10 in advance, $15 at the door, also at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca. And then on Friday, October the 18th, folk singer David Rovix is in town. I believe that's a benefit for the Federal Fellowship of Reconciliation. $10 donation being suggested at the Common Good Cafe, the University Temple United Methodist Church, 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District. So something for you every day this week.
Also,
stay busy.
Thursday, 7 p.m. at Common Good Cafe, Ray McGovern, former CIA.
Oh, yeah. Somehow I missed that. So, yeah, that was the one evening we're missing. Thank you.
All right. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
And don't forget to call in for your tickets for the Social Justice Film Festival.
And again, at Eat the State, we'll have endorsements, recommendations for the ballot coming up in the next week.